WHYY in Philadelphia. I'm Terry Gross with Fresh Air. The New Hampshire primary is less than a month away. On this edition of Fresh Air, we look at presidential politics. Ron Walters examines the power of the black vote. He says blacks are being increasingly ignored by both of the major parties, even though the black vote can provide a critical margin of victory in a close election. Walters is a professor at Howard University who has also served as deputy campaign manager for Jesse Jackson. Also, veteran political reporter Jules Whitcover examines the cavalier way in which we choose a vice president. And TV critic David Bianculli has two shows you should see and one you should absolutely avoid. That's all coming up on Fresh Air. First, the news.
From National Public Radio News in Washington, I'm Corva Coleman. The United Nations Security Council today unanimously urged Libya to surrender two agents indicted by the United States and Great Britain in connection with the bombing of Pan Am Flight 103. Western diplomats say they don't know of another case in which the Council has taken sides in a legal dispute among member states. The vote from the 15-member Council came after Libya declared that the indictments were baseless and that the matter should be submitted to international arbitration. Tripoli has refused to give up the two men but says they can stand trial in Libya. The Bush administration lobbied on Capitol Hill today for a proposal that would give poor families tax credits to pay for the school of their choice, public or private. Education Secretary Lamar Alexander criticized legislation that would allow parents to use federal money only for public schools. NPR's Elizabeth Arnold reports.
Education Secretary Lamar Alexander went to the Capitol today and launched a partisan attack against Democrats who support a bill that would authorize $850 million for school improvements.
It's really a choice between a block grant for more of the same, status quo, business as usual, that's the Kennedy bill, or block grants to parents for choice, to teachers for flexibility, and communities for break-the-mold schools. That's the president's proposal.
Debate on the Democrats' bill, sponsored by Senator Edward Kennedy, began today. The administration supports Republican amendments that are aimed at putting private schools into the mix of schools parents can choose from. But opponents say that will leave the poorest students in the inner cities in the worst schools. Alexander said today if the bill passes without being amended, he will recommend a veto. I'm Elizabeth Arnold at the Capitol.
A former major general in the KGB told a Senate committee today he sticks to his story that the Soviet intelligence service interviewed two or three Americans held in Hanoi years after the end of the Vietnam War. NPR's Neil Conan reports.
Former KGB agent Oleg Kalugin testified that he dispatched an aide to Hanoi sometime between 1976 and 1978 to recruit Americans for the KGB. He maintained that the aide, Viktor Nichiporenko, selected three from amongst the handful of Americans still being held in Vietnam to speak with, but that the recruitment didn't work out. And Kalugin stuck to his story, even though all of the governments involved, including the U.S., say there's nothing to support it, and even though his former aide, Nichiporenko, denies it too. Perhaps, General Kalugin said, the old guard of the KGB wants to protect relations with Vietnam, one of its last listening posts anywhere in the world. General Kalugin said he had no motive to make up such a story, said he didn't know how many Americans were allegedly in Hanoi when his aide made the trip, a handful was his best guess, and said he believes none is there now. This is Neil Conan in Washington.
Stocks fell on Wall Street. The Dow dropped 32 points to close at 3223. This is NPR. One day before the 19th anniversary of the Supreme Court's Roe v. Wade decision, thousands of anti-abortion activists demonstrated in the Capitol. Members of Operation Rescue attempted to block the entrances to several Washington-area clinics. John Greenberg reports.
This is the third year that Operation Rescue has come to Washington. As in the past, members converged on clinics where the group says abortions are performed. The anti-abortion protesters pack themselves around the entrances to the clinics and refuse to move. Abortion rights activists lined up, arms linked together, in an effort to keep those entrances clear. Tension between the two groups seemed greater this year than last, with more personal confrontations between their members.
3 weeks after conception, the baby's heart is beating.
When the police arrived, the anti-abortion protesters went limp and were dragged away in handcuffs. Police say they arrested 278 people. They will likely be fined $50. More demonstrations are expected tomorrow. For National Public Radio, this is John Greenberg in Washington.
The standoff between Caterpillar Incorporated and the United Auto Workers has now entered its 11th week. Spokesmen for both sides say they have not budged from their demands in a strike that has idled half of Caterpillar's 16,000 UAW workers and led to some layoffs. Strong inventories and slow, recession-plagued markets have cushioned the strike somewhat for the company. But analysts say that the equipment market could grow in early spring, and Caterpillar could be caught short of inventory if it does not resolve the dispute before then. NASA is preparing the shuttle Discovery for flight tomorrow. The inventory includes 72 million roundworms, 32 million mouse bone cells, and 3 billion yeast cells. That Discovery will also carry seeds, insects, bacteria, and mold. The scientific mission is intended to study the loss of gravity on these items. I'm Corva Coleman, NPR.
This is Fresh Air. I'm Terry Gross. With Governor Wilder out of the race, there's no black candidate running in the presidential primaries. You might think that the candidates would be courting black voters. But a new report from the Urban League says that the candidates are virtually ignoring the civil rights and economic concerns of African Americans. My guest Ron Walters is the author of a book on black presidential politics in America. Walters is a professor at Howard University. He's also advised members of the Congressional Black Caucus and was deputy campaign manager for Jesse Jackson. He's a former board member of the Southern Christian Leadership Conference. Walters estimates that there are 10 million black voters in the country, largely centered in the Democratic Party. He says the black vote was critical in the election of Jimmy Carter, but these days the black vote seems to wield less influence in the Democratic Party.
There's been a tendency on the part of the Democratic Party to want to hold the black vote at some arm's length, based on the proposition that the American electorate has increasingly identified the Democratic Party as the party of minorities, meaning substantially the party of blacks. And that has been a critical factor in the decision of many people to switch and vote Republican. So Democrats, Democratic leaders, Democratic Party nominees are sensitive to that. And there's been a trend toward not campaigning as vigorously in the black community. Of course, blacks have responded to that with the higher levels of alienation. Blacks, of course, one of those groups who are refusing to call themselves increasingly strong Democrats in the surveys of voter identification.
Well, why are Democrats starting to see the black vote as a liability?
Well, I think it has a lot to do with the strength of the conservative movement. I think when you see the shift in voter identification from Democrat to Republican, especially in the South, but really all over the country, the drama of course, the Reagan administration and the awe with his landslides, the national tide and the strength of the conservative movement, when you see that and the fact that the Democrats have been out of power for so long, it has built a kind of respect for the conservative temper of the American electorate on the part of Democratic leadership. And so I think that basically what you had was the beginning in the early 1970s. Black people had just come out of a civil rights movement. Now, whites responded to that movement in some positive ways, but there was also a negative backlash. And I think really that negative backlash began to set up the seeds of a counter-reaction to the civil rights movement. And when you combine that with the tough economic times of the early 1970s, I think you had all of the ingredients of a full-scale revolt against racial preferences and progress in America. And that culminated, I think, in the far more conservative age that we have today.
Thomas Etzel, in his new book, Chain Reaction, which is about race and politics, says that 1964, the election immediately following the passage of the Civil Rights Act, an election won by Lyndon Johnson, was the last presidential election in which racial liberalism was seen as politically advantageous. Do you agree with that?
Well, of course, I don't necessarily agree with that. I think racial liberalism was advantageous in the election of 1968. I think if he's talking about the Democratic Party, I think that racial liberalism was functional through the election of Jimmy Carter. And I think it's only been recently, when you look at the crop of Democratic candidates running for president and the election of 1988, I think there you began to get a very serious difference. No longer was it very fashionable to say that you were a liberal. And the L word, of course, was really not the thing to be identified with. So when you look at this crop of candidates today, in perspective to those in 1988, you have a continuation of a trend where people are not only refusing to identify themselves as liberal, but also gravitating far more closely to a conservative, Republican-oriented type of public policy philosophy than ever before, to the point where I would argue today there's very little distinction between some of the people who are running for president on the Democratic side and some of the policies that have been pursued by Republicans, both in the White House and in the Congress.
Do you think that black voters are seen by many white politicians as being a special interest group, and that many white politicians would be afraid of being seen as, quote, beholden to blacks?
I think that the whole definition of the Democratic Party, the characterization of the Democratic Party, which emerged as a party that favored special interest groups, that particular characterization had a lot to do with defining the Democratic Party as the party of blacks. It also meant labor, women's groups, and so forth. And when you look at these movements, blacks, women, and labor, all of these were political movements of recent times that have one way or another alienated a very important group, white males, white liberals, white middle-class males. And that was the group that has been far more loyal to the conservative movement and was the base of Ronald Reagan's support. So, yes, it is true that even though any major political party is comprised of special interest, and certainly the Republican Party is, that when you talk about special interest, it is and has in many quarters become a code word for the black part of the Democratic Party's constituency.
We've seen many more black conservatives in the media lately, you know, writing op-ed pieces. Clarence Thomas was a good example of a black conservative coming to prominence, and a lot of the people who supported him became more public during the hearings, and we got to see a lot of them. Do you think that there is a larger black conservative vote now, and do you think the black vote is becoming less monolithic than it ever was?
Well, I don't think necessarily the black conservatives have much of a constituency in the black community. And the reason for that, of course, is that their policies, their programs, really fly in the face of the majority interests of the black community. So that it's very difficult to locate a significant base that they have. On the other hand, I don't think that the black community was ever really monolithic in the sense of the fact that everybody believed everything 100%. There are certain conditions that made it necessary that black people think the same way about a lot of issues. One of them had to do with racism. The prevalence of racism that black people face in society, regardless of class, has given them a very similar attitude about racism and what to do about racism. So that to the extent that you continue to have it, you will continue to have a very strong unity of opinion about many things racial. With respect to economics, I think there you find probably the most divergence in the black community. What to do about economic policy, I think changes with one's personal circumstances. But I think there is, on most issues, what one could call a mainstream. And I think America really doesn't quite understand that these issues, which comprise the black mainstream, come out of the history of blacks, what they have experienced in America, and the striking similarity of how they're treated today.
If you're just joining us, my guest is Ron Walters. He's a professor of political science at Howard University, author of a book on black presidential politics in America, and he's advised members of the Congressional Black Caucus and was a consultant and a campaign manager for Jesse Jackson. We're going to take a short break and then talk some more. This is Fresh Air. Thank you. My guest is Ron Walters, professor of political science at Howard and author of a book on black presidential politics in America. Do you think that racism is being manipulated in the primary campaigns? And let's start with the Democrats, and then we'll move to the Republicans.
Well, I certainly think racism is being manipulated because today there are so many ways to talk about race without actually discussing it.
Yeah. So you think there's code issues or code words being used now?
Yes. There are many sort of racially loaded, I call them race-valued terms, that are being used, and they are part now of the public dialogue, where the subtext, if we could call it that, really is a discussion about race or a dialogue about race. And there are issues such as crime. For example, we saw the very important role that the crime has played in the popular culture and in the imagination of many people, of course, that conjures up the black criminal and the role that blacks play in crime. The same thing about welfare, the same thing about such issues as teenage pregnancy or homelessness. To the extent that blacks are involved in these areas disproportionately, even though whites may be also involved in a larger sense, it makes no difference. They become identified with the black community, and therefore some of the measures that are being discussed about them are just horrendous. For example, there are legislators in the state of California and in the state of Kansas that have made proposals about welfare, which have to do with reducing the welfare caseload by sterilizing welfare recipients, free female welfare recipients, with some of the latest devices. Now, if in any other society, in any other time, if we had heard these proposals spoken out loud on the floor of a state legislature, we would have been appalled. But in this atmosphere, people can make such proposals. And I think subliminally on everybody's mind, there is a racial dynamic to it, which really is unspoken. And that is the insidious aspect of about it.
Do you think there's any particular candidate on the Democratic side who is doing the most to play on racial fears?
Well, I think that, again, I would say that Clinton's formulation of the welfare issue, which has to do with responsibility, quote-unquote, is, I think, the closest one could come to that kind of a syndrome that I'm discussing. To the extent, for example, that most of the people on welfare in the state of Arkansas are black, and we're talking about 60% of the people in his state are black. And then I think it obviously becomes sort of a racially charged issue to discuss welfare and coming out of his particular situation.
Let's look at the Republican Party. This is a party in which one of the people running in the primary is actually a former member of the Klan. How do you think David Duke has been using or avoiding the issue of race in his campaign?
Well, I think David Duke has become very sophisticated using these sort of code words that I've been discussing. The issue of welfare in a state like Louisiana, he has used very effectively when everybody knew, of course, he was talking about blacks. I think in the state of Louisiana, the welfare budget only constituted 2% of the general budget of the state. So you would think, of course, that this was a major, major problem. And it was, in fact, the problem that was keeping whites from being successful, if you listen to David Duke. But it really is a tiny part of the total expenditures of that state. And I would say the same thing about the national picture, that welfare is not the main problem in this country. And yet you have David Duke using that issue very successfully.
Let's look at President Bush during his last campaign. He used the Willie Horton story. That was interpreted by a lot of people as a not very coded way of playing on racial fears. Do you see anything like that emerging this time around?
Well, I think that they may not use the Willie Horton situation again because it drew so much public criticism. And so much post-fact and after-the-fact analysis by the press. But they may go on and use something else. And right now, I can't tell you what that is, but I'm sure that because of the power of racial symbolism and because it has proved to be a defining issue. I think that his handlers may find a way to use it once again.
The black vote is seen as an almost liability in some sectors. Some politicians are afraid to be seen as representing black interests. Do you think that fear comes out of a belief that there are a lot of racist white voters who will vote against blacks or against black issues, or do you think that the issue is more an economic one than a racial one?
Well, I think it's the issue is really both cultural and political. I think in one sense it is cultural because many whites genuinely believe that blacks have gone through a generation of racial preference, of which all of these preferences were accorded them, and they were accorded them at the expense of whites, and now is enough. Now, I think that what we ought to do really is to match up that particular sentiment with some reality. And to that extent, one of the tremendous and tragic things that has happened to us is that our friends in the Democratic Party and in the intellectual world did not really stand up to that sentiment and to talk about, with any sense of accuracy or equity, this whole business of racial preferences. So that this has become ingrained in the mind of many people, and they have used that as a scapegoat for their own deleterious circumstances. And it is really pernicious. And let me just illustrate. I think it's pernicious because when you come to an issue like economic development, what will pull our economy out of the doldrums? There are many politicians now on the Democratic side who are arguing for middle-class tax cuts when most of the, I would say, the reputable economists would say that spending for infrastructure would create jobs far more quickly. You have a distinguished economist like John Kenneth Galbraith who has just put this forward in one of the congressional hearings. And one of the reasons why you probably won't get as much of an emphasis on spending for infrastructure is that people think that it will re-empower people in the urban sector. And you haven't heard any of these candidates, for example, talk about an urban policy. And yet there is where you really could get this country moving again by spending on all sorts of the infrastructure that are necessary for people to make a very decent standard of living. So you won't get that discussion, you won't get that emphasis because of this trade-off now between the interest of the middle class, essentially the white middle class, and the interest of blacks in the minds of many people, and the fact that one policy has been associated with the Democratic Party traditionally.
If you're just joining us, my guest is Ron Walters. He's a professor of political science at Howard University, author of a book about black presidential politics in America, and he's been a consultant to several members of the Congressional Black Caucus and a consultant to Jesse Jackson's campaigns as well. What is the state of debate now among black activists about whether there should be a third political party?
Well, I think that you have two candidates out there today. One is Lenore Fulani of the New Alliance Party, and the other is Ron Daniels of Project New Tomorrow. Both of them, of course, black independent candidates, and therefore heirs to a trend of thought in the black community that goes back a considerable period of time. But I think most recently back to 1980. When, in fact, in that year, there was an attempt to form a national black party. In fact, it was called the National Black Independent Political Party. And that came about because of a strong dissatisfaction with the two-party system, with the fact that even then the two parties didn't seem to be as responsive. And quite frankly, with an attempt to try to make the electoral arena very dynamic. You have to realize that coming out of the civil rights movement, people were used to a very dynamic political theater. And elections, of course, are relatively slow, a mechanism for social change. And so the party idea was an attempt to try to invigorate it, to bring more blacks into it, more dynamism, add more leverage to the black vote. Now, some people think that this isn't a valid proposition. I tend to think that it does have at least a ring of theoretical possibility. If we look at the last election, the difference between the two candidates was not that great. $41 million for Michael Dukakis, the $47 million for George Bush. The black vote itself, as I've already indicated, is far more than that. It could be 10 million. So the black vote alone could really make the difference between the two candidates. And therefore, that sets up the prospect of a leverage politics between the two parties.
So you think a black political party would ensure that Democrats and Republicans couldn't take the black vote for granted? Everybody would have to really work for it. It would become a significant force.
I think so. To the extent that it was going, that 10 million votes was going to be cast, I think that there would have to be then some competition for some part of that electorate. I don't think either side really could afford to forget about it because it's simply too large. And as I said, if you look at the difference between the two parties, it's not been all that great. And so it is a force to be reckoned with, and I think it would engender some serious competition. Add to that the fact that it wouldn't just be a black party. I think that, again, historically, progressive whites have wanted to join in a coalition with some kind of independent force that was effective. The National Organization of Women indicated that they might form a political party. Labor hinted that they might form a political party. So if you do get a restructured Democratic Party in the form of this new coalition, it could turn out to be a very decisive force in American politics.
Are you for the development of a third party?
I see a dawning reality at this particular moment in American politics, and that is that there is such a shading going on between the Democratic and Republican Party that you might as well call both sides of the party Republicrats. And if you look at Clinton's campaign at the moment and ask yourself, what is the real difference between a Clinton, who is the theoretical winner, and a George Bush? There's very little room there. And so at issue for me is really the remaining character of the Democratic Party. That is a very important residual question to ask right now. And if you come to the conclusion that there is very little difference now, that the dynamics of the pressures out in the electorate are pushing both parties to a sameness, then that's an argument for perhaps not a third political party, but a genuine second political party. And it may happen because if the Democratic Party becomes, in fact, a carbon copy of the Republican Party, then I think naturally what you will begin to have is a reformulation of the party structure. There are some groups are going to be disaffected, will pull away, and try to seek their own interest in a different formulation. And so we may be at a very critical moment in the history of the two-party system, and it may be beyond just the question of race. It may be the dissolution of the Democratic Party as a party, which has a distinct characteristic.
Ron Walters is a professor of political science at Howard University and the author of Black Presidential Politics in America. He's consulted to members of the Congressional Black Caucus and Jesse Jackson. I'm Terry Gross, and this is Fresh Air.
Major funding for Fresh Air is provided by the Corporation for Public Broadcasting. Additional support comes from the listeners of WHYY in Philadelphia, where Fresh Air is produced. This is NPR, National Public Radio.
From Philadelphia, I'm Terry Gross with Fresh Air. To a lot of people, the office of vice president is a joke, and Dan Quayle is just the current punchline. But of the 9 presidents we've had since World War II, 3 were vice presidents who assumed the nation's highest office unexpectedly. That's just one of the reasons veteran political reporter Jules Whitcover says we should put more care into choosing vice presidents. Coming up, we talk with Whitcover. He's written a new book about the vice presidency called Crapshoot. And TV critic David Bianculli warns us away from one of the worst shows he's seen in years. That's all coming up on Fresh Air. From National Public Radio News in Washington, I'm Jessica Berman. The U.S. Supreme Court this morning agreed to review a major abortion case, opening the door for a possible reexamination of the landmark Roe v. Wade abortion decision. NPR's Nina Totenberg reports.
At issue in the case is a Pennsylvania law erecting a variety of barriers to getting an abortion, barriers such as a requirement for notifying a husband and a 24-hour waiting period. In 1986, the Supreme Court struck down a nearly identical law as unconstitutional, ruling that it violated a woman's fundamental right to an abortion. But last year, a lower court upheld most provisions of the law, declaring that the Supreme Court's rulings on abortion had changed. Both sides appealed to the Supreme Court, with pro-choice forces asking directly whether Roe v. Wade is still the law of the land. Today, the justices agreed to hear the case, thus all but guaranteeing that there will be some kind of a decision on whether to reverse Roe v. Wade this term before the presidential election. I'm Nina Totenberg at the Supreme Court.
The United Nations Security Council unanimously adopted a resolution today calling on Libya to hand over 2 men charged with blowing up Pan Am Flight 103. 270 people were killed in the 1988 bombing of the aircraft over Lockerbie, Scotland. The resolution also condemns the destruction of a French airliner over West Africa in 1989, in which 170 people were killed. Libya has so far refused to turn over the suspects, offering instead to settle the matter through arbitration. President Bush today said he's going to ask Congress for more money to fund Head Start, the 27-year-old federal program that provides disadvantaged children with at least a year of preschool and an array of health services. NPR's Claudio Sanchez reports.
President Bush told parents and elected officials at a Head Start center right outside Baltimore, Maryland, that he wants $600,000 more for Head Start, the largest single increase ever. Government programs cannot replace the family, Bush said.
But in Head Start, we found a government program that works to strengthen communities and families for the future.
As many as 157,000 children could be enrolled with the added funding. Critics say the increase makes for good campaign politics, but the president's proposal would still leave 2/3 of the eligible children across the country without Head Start. Democrats in Congress say they want a $1 billion increase for the program, which now costs a little over $2 billion. For every dollar spent on Head Start since 1965, experts say the government has saved $7 in health, educational, and social service costs. I'm Claudio Sanchez in Washington.
Stocks closed lower on Wall Street today, with the Dow Jones Industrials losing 32 points to close at 3223.39. Declines led advances by a margin of more than 2-1 in heavy trading of approximately 219 million shares. This is NPR News. Investigators in France are trying to learn what caused a state-of-the-art airliner with an experienced crew to crash into a mountain on a routine flight yesterday. The disaster involving an Airbus A320 left 87 people dead. 9 others survived. Cuba today declared war on its dissidents a day after a firing squad executed an exile accused of leading a Miami-based infiltration team. The condemned man, Eduardo Diaz Betancourt, allegedly headed a 3-man commando team that planned a series of terrorist bombings. State Department spokesman Richard Boucher denounced the execution, saying the Cuban government showed its true face. Cuba has long insisted the armed dissidents are tools of the CIA. Opening arguments took place today in the trial of former Detroit Police Chief William Hart. Hart is accused of stealing $2.5 million from a secret fund intended for undercover drug operations. Don Gagne has this report from Detroit.
Prosecutors opened their case by telling the jury that William Hart took $1.3 million for himself by writing checks from the fund made out to cash. and that he funneled the rest of the money to a man named Kenneth Weiner, a one-time high-ranking police department official who set up dummy corporations to receive the checks. Weiner has already pleaded guilty in a separate case related to his role in the theft. The prosecution says there are no documents showing that Hart took the money for his own personal use, but they say from 1985 to 87, his lifestyle far exceeded what he could afford based on his annual salary. Hart's attorney, during his opening statement, countered that there's no proof that his client stole any money, maintaining that Hart is an honest cop who was a victim of an elaborate con set up by Kenneth Weiner. The trial is expected to last several months. For National Public Radio, this is Don Gagne in Detroit.
The state of Wyoming edged closer to its first execution since 1965, with convicted killer Mark Hopkinson scheduled to be put to death by lethal injection early Wednesday. You're listening to National Public Radio News in Washington.
This is Fresh Air. A couple of weeks ago, we woke up to reports that President Bush had passed out at a state dinner in Japan. It was just the flu, but it reminded us all that the vice president truly is just a heartbeat away from the presidency. Perhaps no vice president in recent memory has been held in such low regard as Dan Quayle. The cavalier manner in which he was selected by Bush is one reason why Jules Whitcover wrote the new book, Crapshoot, about how vice presidents are chosen. Whitcover is a veteran political reporter and syndicated columnist. Another reason he wrote the book is that he has personally witnessed the assassination of one presidential candidate, Robert Kennedy, the attempted assassination of one president, Gerald Ford, and an assassination hoax against another presidential candidate, Ronald Reagan. As far as Whitcover is concerned, choosing a vice president who can learn on the job isn't good enough.
The fact is that in 1988, when George Bush ran for president, his slogan was ready from day one. He was referring, of course, to his great number of high jobs that he'd held in the past to indicate that he was ready to take over at a moment's notice. The vice president, however, also should have as a slogan ready from day one, because the possibility of him having to take over on short notice, perhaps even in the first day of his vice presidency, is present. You'll recall in 1981 that George Bush was vice president only a few weeks when the assassination attempt was made on Ronald Reagan, and we learned later that it was almost succeeded. So my argument in this book is not against Dan Quayle, but really against George Bush and against other presidents who don't make a responsible choice. I think that the idea that the vice presidency is a training ground is fine. As long as the vice president has the time and the country has the luxury of him being in that office for some time. But I believe the majority of the vice presidents who have succeeded to the presidency succeeded in the first year of their vice presidency. So therefore, the vice president should be ready to take over, not the vice presidency, which is a job that doesn't require much heavy lifting, but be ready to take over the presidency from the moment he goes into office.
But instead, you think vice presidential running mates are chosen for what reasons? To round out the ticket?
Often to round out the ticket, geographically or ethnically, perhaps. But I think that we've had a mixed record on vice presidents. That's why the book is called Crapshoot. It's not that every vice president has been a bad one. More often than not, they've been non-entities who have disappeared from the scene. But at least since World War II, vice presidents have not disappeared from the scene. And the office has now become a stepping stone, and probably the most important stepping stone to the presidency, quite aside from the matter of accidental succession. In six of the last seven presidential campaigns, for example, either one or both of the presidential nominees had been vice president. So although the vice presidency used to be a job that was avoided by ambitious politicians and really a dead end, because for most of the Republic, the history of the Republic, a vice president served for only one term and were out. So therefore, it was not a job that people welcomed. But in recent years, it has been a job that people have welcomed because of the recent record that it is indeed the prime stepping stone to the presidency.
Did you, during the course of the research for your book, get some new insights into how George Bush made the decision to get Quayle to be his running mate?
Well, I got some ideas, but I wouldn't say they were insights, or would I be able to say that this is really the reason? When George Bush did select Dan Quayle originally, he merely stated that he thought Dan Quayle represented the next generation, and he mentioned a couple of fairly minor legislative acts in support of his choice. And so there's been, and he has never to this day really given a detailed explanation of why he picked Dan Quayle. My own guess is that that George Bush served for 8 years as vice president in a manner in which he was widely criticized as being overly subservient and super loyal. But my own theory is that George Bush convinced himself that that is the way indeed that a vice president should behave. And therefore, when the time came for him to make a choice, he wanted somebody who, in a general way, served the vice in the vice presidency as he did. Also, when he took over the party at the convention in New Orleans in 1988, his advisors, some of his advisors, told him it was important for him to do something dramatic to show that he was indeed in charge and coming out of the shadow of Ronald Reagan. And he did something dramatic, certainly in naming Dan Quayle, who sent the convention into shock.
What about the theory that Quayle was chosen because he was young enough to perhaps have appeal to the baby boom generation, and he was considered very attractive?
Oh, sure. I think that was that obviously was a factor, but it proved not to really work out that way in the election.
What's your assessment of Quayle's performance so far as vice president? He's no longer like the shocking choice to be the running mate. He's been, you know, performing in that position for several years.
I think he's been adequate as vice president. I think he's worked quite hard to get on top of the relatively routine tasks given to him. I went on a trip to Eastern Europe with him last spring. He handled most of the ceremonial assignments adequately. He was well briefed and seemed to absorb the briefings. But I came away nevertheless feeling that there was not much innovative thought there. There was not much sense of real leadership. I think I get back to my other point that being vice president is not a job requiring heavy lifting, and that is not. What you need to gauge somebody on how they perform those ceremonial duties, but whether they are perceived as being capable of taking over the presidency, which brings me to a point that I'd like to elaborate on, if I may. There's been so much talk about Quayle, whether or not he is qualified, and you know who's really to say whether any person is qualified to become president in advance. We've had vice presidents who were good and didn't seem in advance that they would be. But I think there's this point. When a vice president takes over, either through the death of a president or his resignation, the country goes into a period of trauma. We saw it, I think, indisputably with the assassination of John Kennedy in 1963, and we saw it again to a degree in 1974 with the resignation of Richard Nixon. In both those cases, the vice president who assumed the office was a man who was perceived by the people as being competent to get the country through this very traumatic period. Lyndon Johnson in the first instance, Gerald Ford perhaps lesser, but still seen as a competent person in the second instance. I think that's what we have to think about, that the country does go into a trauma when we have that kind of a shock. And it's important that the person who is going to move up into the presidency be perceived as able to get the country through this crisis. I would just suggest that if something happened to George Bush tonight, Dan Quayle would not be perceived as a person who would be able to get the country through that traumatic experience as Lyndon Johnson did in 1963 or as Gerald Ford did in 1974.
Do you think that George Bush should have basically dumped Quayle and chosen a different vice presidential running mate this time around?
Well, my own judgment is, as I indicated, that there are probably people who would instill more confidence. I'm sure there were people who would instill more confidence than Dan Quayle does. But I don't think it's likely that we're going to see that happen. George Bush, after all, contended that Dan Quayle was was ready to be president, or at least that was the implication in his selection in 1988 of Dan Quayle. So the idea that he would, 4 years later, in effect, say he was not qualified is not likely to happen. I mean, if they did replace him, I think what would have to happen would be that people around the president would have to go to Quayle and say, look, you're hurting the president's chances of re-election, and the decent thing to do is to step aside. I'm not altogether sure that would work. Interestingly, in 1956, Harold Stassen urged President Eisenhower to drop Richard Nixon. And in fact, Eisenhower did call Nixon in and suggest that he might like to be Secretary of Defense. Nixon refused to buckle to that and stayed on the ticket.
If you're just joining us, my guest is Jules Whitcover, and his new book is called Crapshoot, Rolling the Dice on the Vice Presidency, and it's a historical overview of the Vice Presidency and a look at the Vice President today. We're going to take a short break, and then we'll talk some more. This is Fresh Air. Just joining us, my guest is syndicated columnist Jules Whitcover, whose new book is on the vice presidency. Do you think that whoever wins the Democratic nomination will choose their vice presidential running mate differently than Bush, having learned some kind of lesson by the way Quayle was received?
Well, the fact is that over the last several years, the Democrats have gone out about picking a vice president in a different way. You recall that Jimmy Carter in 1976 had a number of prominent Democrats troop down to Plains, and he interviewed them personally and spent a great deal of time examining the possibilities. Michael Dukakis did the same thing. It's interesting to me that the Republicans have viewed that process as demeaning, and they've criticized it, and they have said, most of them, that they are not going to put the prospective vice presidential nominees through this demeaning process. I think that's very short-sighted, and I think maybe one of the reasons they got into trouble with the Dan Quayle selection. Not so much that George Bush would have made a different choice, but the visible examination of Quayle might have created the same sort of stir in the Republican Party before the convention that did in fact occur at the convention when the news came that it was going to be Quayle.
Would you like to see the process reformed by which the president chooses his vice presidential running mate?
Well, if voters did their job, that is, that if they saw a choice made by the presidential nominee that they felt was reckless or irresponsible or cavalier and punished the presidential nominee for making that choice, then I would say the system is fine. But the fact is that voters don't do that. They don't vote for the second man on the ticket, and they don't hold the first man on the ticket responsible for the person who he selects as his running mate. So I would like to see some kind of backstop for the public, some protection against an irresponsible or reckless choice. One of the ideas that's been around for some time and I would like to see resurrected is the idea that that there would not be a running mate on the ticket, that the convention would only nominate a presidential nominee. Then after the election, the president-elect would then nominate a vice president subject to the confirmation of Congress, basically the same procedure that's followed now in the 25th Amendment. I think there are some advantages to that approach. One is that the president-elect obviously would not have to consider geography, ethnicity, religion, or any other factor in selecting his vice president, other than the one that they all say they use, but they seldom do, that is to pick the person best qualified. Also, there are a number of very qualified people who don't want to go through the rigors of a campaign, and they might be more willing to serve if that was a procedure. They would, of course, have to go before Congress and face interrogation, but also so would the president-elect. Now, when it would be harder to require a president, a sitting president, to come in and defend his choice, because the president could say, well, you know, because of conflict, because of a separation of powers, a president should not be required to appear before Congress. But a president-elect would not be in office, so Congress could require him to come in and say why in great detail, considerable detail, why he made the choice. And I would just suggest that if that kind of procedure had been in place in 1988, George Bush may have thought twice about picking Dan Quayle if he knew he had to come in and defend him in depth, something that, as I said before, George Bush has not done to this day.
What gives you confidence that this process would work better? A lot of people have been confirmed by congressional committees who a lot of other people think are highly unqualified to serve. So I'm not sure that that you'd be any more satisfied with the choice.
There's no assurance that it would be a better choice, but at least it would not be one person's choice solely and without any challenge.
There'd be some check on it.
It would be some check. And that's the thing that I think is necessary, that if the presidential nominee makes a good choice, fine. If he doesn't, we're stuck with it. And we might be stuck with it in this process, too, but at least there would be a review by the elected representatives of the people.
How many times have you covered the New Hampshire primaries?
Since the 60s.
What do you like about it, and what do you really dread about this time of year?
What I like about New Hampshire is that it's a small state. You can stay in one place, get your laundry done. You can travel all over the state and come back and sleep in the same hotel room every night. Get to know a lot of the people who have been there for years. And because it is retail campaigning, the candidates, although they do use a great deal of television now, whereas a few years ago they didn't because it came out of Boston and it was too costly, they use a lot now. They still do retail campaigning. And it's a leveling process. You don't have to have a huge amount of money to get your case across, and I think that's good.
What do you mean by retail campaigning?
I mean going door to door, going to town halls, going to churches, and meeting people one on one.
Okay. Thank you very much for talking with us.
Thank you.
When are you going back to New Hampshire?
Tonight.
Have a good trip.
Thank you.
Jules Woodcover's new book is Crapshoot, Rolling the Dice on the Vice Presidency. This is Fresh Air. Robert Siegel's with us. Robert, what's coming up on All Things Considered?
We have a report today, Terry, from Nina Totenberg about the U.S. Supreme Court agreeing to hear a challenge soon to Pennsylvania's abortion law. And that means it is possible, that the Supreme Court would rule on whether Roe v. Wade is still the law of the land before the November election. So we'll see what happens. Also, this evening, we'll be hearing a report from Tom Gelton about safety or lack of safety at nuclear power plants in Russia and some other republics of what used to be the Soviet Union. And we'll be talking with Senator Al Gore about environmentalism. He believes that preserving the Earth's environment should become the organizing principle of all civilization.
Thanks, Robert. That and more on All Things Considered from National Public Radio. Television critic David Bianculli planned to discuss two new shows this week, but he just can't shake the awful memory of another one which premiered last week.
If I could have gotten this other show out of my system, I'd be talking about some really good stuff today. For one thing, there's Prime Suspect, a three-part PBS miniseries that begins this week on Mystery. It stars Helen Mirren as a chief inspector who tries to catch a serial killer and deal with sexual harassment office politics at the same time. She's wonderful, and so is the story. For another thing, there's a Frontline documentary on PBS tonight that looks at the political reach of the Unification Church. It's a strong program, tracing significant links between George Bush, Ronald Reagan, Orrin Hatch, and Oliver North, and the Church of the Reverend Sum Young Moon. But instead of these good shows, I can't stop thinking about a bad one. Last Friday, CBS premiered a new series by Don Bellisario, the creator of Quantum Leap. This new series is called Tequila and Bonetti, and it's not just bad, it's historically awful. I really do think it's the worst series in years. Tequila and Bonetti is a real dog, and it stars a real dog, a police dog named Tequila. He's partnered with a tough New York cop named Bonetti, who's temporarily reassigned to Los Angeles. And bad as this premise sounds, it's actually a lot worse, because the dog talks. Or at least he thinks, and we can hear his thoughts. I guess I didn't want to call this show Look Who's Barking, but that's the basic idea. And to make matters worse, which hardly seems possible, the voice of Tequila, a big brown dog, is provided by actor Brad Sanders in what network TV likes to call a, quote, streetwise style. Streetwise, of course, is TV speak for just walked off the set of Superfly. Here's how the dog sniffs out a crime scene.
Okay, what do we got here? Female Caucasian, 40s, wears Joy for two. What's this? Bay rum and a poodle. And coming in the heat soon. Oh, wow.
The show is sexist as well as racist. It tries to be dramatic as well as funny, and it doesn't even work as a premise. We can hear the dog thoughts, but the cop can't, so there's no real interaction. It's like Mr. Ed if Wilbur couldn't hear him talk. Here's a scene where Bonetti visits his ex-wife, who's arguing with him when Tequila enters the room. I figure there's something here to offend just about anybody.
I'm stupida. Should have never gone to the Sons of Italy for Angie's wedding.
You were her bridesmaid. And if you hadn't, we wouldn't have met. And you would have missed the greatest sex since Anthony climbed Cleopatra.
Damn, baby, chill with that squealing.
What's that?
Who, him? It's my partner.
You almost have to see it to disbelieve it. The only reason I can figure that CBS put this show on the air is to make all its other bad new shows, like P.S. I Love You and Hearts Are Wild, look better by comparison. And in that respect, it works, because Tequila and Bonetti is in a lower class all its own. It isn't just a dog. It's what a dog leaves on the sidewalk.
David Bianculli is TV critic for the New York Post.
What a dog. What a dog. He's a tramp, but they love him. Breaks a new heart every day. He's a tramp, they adore him, and I only hope he'll stay that way.
Fresh Air's interviews He's and reviews tramp. Are produced by Amy Sallet, Phyllis Myers, and Naomi Person, with Joan Tuohy and Roberta Shurrock, who also directed today's show with Chris Spurgeon. Research assistance from Ellen Silva. Dorothy Farabee is our administrative assistant. I'm Terry Gross.
Yes, even I have got it pretty bad. You can never tell when he'll show up. He gives you plenty of trouble.
Major funding for Fresh Air is provided by the Corporation for Public Broadcasting. Additional support comes from the listeners of WHYY in Philadelphia, where Fresh Air is produced. This is NPR, National Public Radio.
Gloria Steinem has devoted most of her adult life to the feminist movement. After fighting social and political barriers to equality, she's focusing on the inner barriers to equality. On the next Fresh Air, we talk about her new book, Revolution from Within, a book of self-esteem. I'm Terry Gross. I hope you'll join us for the next Fresh Air.